Turning now for a moment from the issue of who you are as a person, I want to look at the nature of ministry. Because there is an interactive effect between who you are as a person and the unique nature of ministry. There is no job as hazardous as ministry. Now, I could not have said that 30 years ago. Because all the research 30 years ago seemed to indicate that the work of ministry was pretty easy. Ministers lived longer than most other people. It's true. They lived longer. It just felt more painful, but they lived longer. They were healthier. But that has all changed. And for several reasons, suddenly in the last several decades, the hazardous nature of ministry has sort of gone through the roof. A friend of mine, who is an executive pastor for a large church near Los Angeles, recently gave me some information. As the executive pastor for this large church, they have a fairly large pastoral and other staff, it's his responsibility to maintain a health insurance plan for every one of them. We don't have the privileges you have. All our health insurance is covered by private insurance companies. And so you have to make sure that you're covered in some way. And it was his responsibility to keep health plans up to date for their staff. And about 6 months ago, the health insurance that they had for the staff expired, and he had to negotiate a new health plan, and thought that what he would do was to approach the six major health insurance companies in the United States and get quotations from them for their health insurance. And this, his note to me says this: I approached six major national carriers to give a bid for coverage. All six declined to submit offers because, they said, the incidence of emotional and psychological disorders in clergy are too high for them to cover. Six major insurance companies. Finally, he went back to one of the largest and says, hey, we've got to have health insurance now. Just tell us what it would cost. And that carrier then finally agreed to cover them on condition that the insurance rates for the pastoral staff, the clergy, was 6% higher than the national average of all other professions. And they said that was the only way they would cover clergy. Now, I think that the message there is absolutely clear. The work of ministry is about the most hazardous I know. In choosing the ministry, Heinrich Vogel once wrote, one chooses to man an outpost of unequal danger, which threatens not only from without, but also from within. So we see this interactive effect then between who you are as a person that demands that you bring to the task the highest level of maturity that you are able to achieve, that you owe it to those you lead to be the healthiest you can be. They deserve to have you relate to them in significantly healthy ways. But on the other hand, you're embedded in a vocation, in a job that is more hazardous than any other. So that there are really four ways in which ministry is unique. And I wanted to just cover these points quickly before I go back to my earlier statement, my earlier outline. Ministry is unique in four ways. First of all, it is unique in the inadequacy of the preparation of the person of the minister. of all the people helping vocations, ministry does the poorest job of preparing your person. I don't know. You know, I work for a pretty significant seminary. I'd have thought that we'd have it right by now. But again and again, I mean, we struggle to get the right level of balance. Now, part of the problem are students themselves. And I need to share with you right now. I hate students. Now, we have quite a few students here today. But my observation of the Australian scene and the way you train students here, it's different to the States. Let me qualify what I've just said. I say I hate American students. I hate American seminary students. I try to teach a course in the School of Theology on personal growth for ministers in the United States, and ran up against a very significant obstacle. And the obstacle is this, that students at the seminary level do not want to know the truth about ministry. They don't want to know the truth. They want to idealize it. They want to put it on a pedestal. They want to feel that like all the sacrifices they're making, that you know, once the rubber hits the road, once I'm in the pulpit, I mean, this church, the church out there, the church universal, is waiting with open and beckoning arms to receive the gifts that I'm going to bring to them and my contribution. I mean, they have this naive idea, many of them, because most of them will come either straight from college, or if they're coming from another career, would not have had much practical experience in ministry. And will go right through seminary, many of them, until their final year when they get some practicum placements. And so they idealize ministry. They want to put it on a pedestal. And when you begin to talk about the realities of ministry, some of the emotional hazards that I refer to them, that the church isn't perfect. Don't confuse that body of believers that calls itself the local church. Don't confuse that body of people, that gathering of people. Don't confuse that with the universal church of God, that bride of Christ, that hypothetical, you know. Don't confuse them. That body of believers is very much in the making. Some of them have barely got off the ground. So you're not ministering to the perfect church. You're ministering to broken and fallen and imperfect and highly dysfunctional people. That's who you are serving. And that task, for that task, we do not prepare our students adequately. And I'm talking about the United States because I don't know enough to make those comments about here. We desperately need an apprenticeship model of some sort. You know, but the inadequacy of the preparation of the minister is a very, very serious, very, very serious problem. The inadequacy of the preparation. We teach students how to exegete scripture. We give them, you know, good sermon skills. I think we've probably got the best preaching program in the United States. Every hour of the day on Fuller's campus, a student is preaching. Every hour of the day. You can go and sit in chapel in the small little preaching lab and listen to a student preaching. Because that preaching goes on all the time, and that student will preach, and then a small group will go and sit in small discussion and talk about that, and the next student will be there and preaching. You invite your friends and your family and all sorts of people to come in for your preaching practicum. We teach all these skills, but the interpersonal skills, nothing. How do you handle conflict? How do you handle conflict? How does one... We don't teach a theology of emotion. In fact, I challenge many of you here this morning. You probably have not thought through adequately a theology of emotion. What do you teach and preach when it comes to depression? One in five people, at least once in their lifetime, will go through a major depression. What are you doing to prepare them for that experience? It's going to hit them out of the blue. Anger. Guilt. We desperately need a theology of emotion, and we don't prepare people. Because you see, most of us don't adequately know how to deal with these issues for ourselves. I'm hoping that tonight and tomorrow morning I will at least be given an opportunity to share some thoughts with you around each of these topics. The inadequacy of the preparation of the pastor, of the minister, sets one up for the conflict and tensions that will arise. Because the problem with ministry, the real problem with ministry is that it is that you minister to people. I joke around Fuller. If it wasn't for students, Fuller Seminary would be a wonderful place to work in. If it wasn't for people, being in ministry would be the greatest job there is. Now the fact that I'm drawing attention to the brokenness and dysfunctionality of the church is not intended to imply anything but that is the given. I hear pastors all the time complaining, you know, how terrible the congregation is and this person and the other person. And I say to them, you know, you're like the doctor I once met who keeps complaining that the only people who ever come to see him are sick people. You know, that's the given. That's the given. What are you doing about it? What is your prescription? Do you have a healing plan to take a church in its given state? I think we need some help. We need some tools in diagnosing the church. We need to know what the state of a local church is, of that gathering of people who call themselves a church. Often they have a predominant pathology. It fascinates me. You go to one church and the whole church is paranoid. The whole solid church is paranoid. You go to another church and everyone is narcissistic. I mean, you know. But the inadequacy of the preparation of the pastor and too often inadequate skills. The churches that they assign to for their very first assignment are the problem churches. Because those are the ones that don't have a pastor. Haven't been able to keep a pastor. They are the churches from hell. Every denominational leader ought to have a catalog. Of those churches from hell. You need to have them report annually on their current index of dysfunctionality and publish that, so beware all who take jobs in these churches. I joke about it, but I mean it seriously, that's the given, you see. It isn't otherwise. It isn't otherwise. But that's the challenge, but the mindset is what I am concerned about. The pastor's mindset ought to be, I'm the doctor here, I'm the physician, I'm the overseer, I'm the under-shepherd. That is what I am called to deal with. And so rather than being reactive to the pathology that one is constantly being confronted with, one has to be able to diagnose and write the prescription for it. And have a program of healing. Makes all the difference in the world if you understand this very, very fundamental point, and that is that if you feel like you're serving a crazy-making church, if you feel like you're crazy, the chances are that you're in a church with tremendous potential for growth. Tremendous potential. The second way in which ministry is unique is in the demands placed on the person of the pastor. It fascinates me how ministry involves who you are as a person intricately with everything you do. Just as everything your family is and does is intricately involved. You can't shunt your family off onto a side and say, well, they don't matter because I just go to work every day. And Scripture is clear about that principle. The overseer who is not able to manage his own family, you know, is almost disqualified for ministry. Now, I don't mean to imply by that because you have a problem kid that you are disqualified from ministry. So let me just put your mind at rest right now. 1 in 3 kids go off the rails no matter what you do. 1 in 3 kids go off the rails no matter what you do. My wife and I raised 3 beautiful daughters. And thank God, I brought them through. And when finally the youngest one turned 21, I dropped on my knees and I said, "Thank you, Lord." It was touch and go at one. Our oldest is actually a clone of me. She is me all over. And we went through a period in her late teens where I thought, well, there's 1 in 3. I was going to say that my 3 survived, so somewhere here there's someone has got more than their fair share. I feel sorry for you. But 1 in 3 will go off the rails. And it doesn't matter how healthy you are as a parent, it just happens. There's too much against us as parents. We've got culture and peers to fight. Our oldest went off the rails in her late teens, and I thought she was done for, but I let her go. I let her go, and I just prayed. I prayed night after night after night that God would just watch over her. And she used to say to me, she said to me, "You know, Dad, you're a psychologist. You should know better than to behave that way towards me, to respond that way toward me. I say, no, honey, you got it all wrong. In this house, I'm not a psychologist. In this house, I'm a father. And fathers are entitled to scream and shout and be irrational. And one day you will be a parent. And you will understand what I mean." Now she is a parent. And she has her PhD also. And she says, "In this house, I'm a mother. And that entitles me to scream and shout and be irrational and everything else." But it was touch and go. But very unique demands placed on the person, on your person. Because, think for example, if who you are in ministry is preoccupied with this thing called success. Now, I pray that none of you here will be successful. You know, that's my prayer for you. Success doesn't teach a thing. Success doesn't teach a thing. In fact, I don't believe God is in the success business. God is in the refining business. And that's what we have to prepare ourselves for. We've got to get to the place where we understand that God is in the refining business. He's not in the success business. Success is the bonus. The only person I believe that God gives success to, legitimate success, a lot of people who seem to be successful, but the only person God gives legitimate success to is the one who can live without it. God doesn't give it to those who don't deserve it. Failure is the fire. Failure is the fire. We learn, that's where we learn character. That's where we learn God's heart. We don't learn it in the successes. And in ministry, the person of the minister is not solidly secure in his own or her own sense of purpose. This is why I'm back to this purpose-driven thing. Unless if you're clear about your purpose, you don't get distracted by success or non-success. You don't get distracted by it. God is not in the success business. He's in the refining business. And refining is part of God's fire. One of my many, many hobbies is goldsmithing. I love to make gold jewelry. My family has to hide every bit of gold they've got, because I have this idea that it should be recycled. You know, "Aren't you tired of that ring, honey? Come, let me make you another ring. I'll melt that down and make it into another ring." "No, Dad, it's okay. This ring's fine. I can live with this ring." I love working with gold. And one of the things you learn when you work with gold is the importance of the refining process. I buy up old gold. I go to pawn shops wherever I travel and see if they've got any good deals of old broken rings. Give me old gold, boy, and I'll turn it into something beautiful. And you get that all gold and you put it in the crucible and then you apply the heat. It takes lots of heat to melt it down, and then you sprinkle some borax on it and all the dirt floats to the surface, and then you pour it. I was showing my grandson the other day. Vincent wanted a ring. He wanted a signet ring. I said, okay, Vincent, I'll make you a signet ring, but on one condition, you got to come and you got to help me make it. And so the first thing I said, we've got to learn how to refine this gold. And so I melt the gold down and it glistens. And then we pour it slowly into a big metal bucket of water, clean water. And it sprinkles and sparkles and settles to the bottom. All the dirt stays on the top. You skim off the dirt, you recover the gold, you put it back in the crucible, and you repeat the process again and again and again. Until finally I said to Vincent, yeah, now it's ready. Now we can turn it into a ring. And when you've refined the gold, all you've got to do is you just have to touch it on the buffing wheel. And it comes up, comes alive like a mirror. Slightest bit of dirt, and it fails to achieve its luster. God's in the refining business. He's in the refining business, and in God's economy, there is no such thing as failure. Only forced growth. Only a little nudge. Not that way, my child. Not that way. This is the way I want you to go. So my prayer for you is that you will not succeed. Now get your mind off that. You need a theology of success and a theology of failure if you're going to survive this ministry stuff. Unique demands placed on your person, internal demands. Also, the third aspect, way in which ministry is unique, is in the seriousness of consequences when things go wrong. Don't you sometimes feel the weightiness of your responsibility? Don't you feel it? Don't you lie awake at night and think, my word, I lost my cool with that person? What if? You know? They don't come back. Or, you know, I blew that sermon. I didn't quite illustrate that well. Or I may have just misrepresented something. And what if someone got turned off to the gospel? Don't you worry about that? Don't you go into a supermarket store and impatiently to the person serving you say something nasty or impatiently, or your anger shows through, and you wonder, what if they knew I was a pastor? And they said, well, if that's what it means to be a Christian, I don't want it. It's heavy stuff, isn't it? And the work itself, I mean, what pastor goes to bed at night feeling absolutely satisfied, I've done everything I could possibly do today? Who? Most go to bed with this pervasive sense of incompleteness. Always something unfinished. Which is one of the reasons why I think pastors need to learn how to partialize. Partializing is being realistic in setting certain goals for the day. If you make a list of things to do in a given day, and at the end of the day, there are things left undone, the sin is not that those things are undone. The sin is that you make lists that are too long. That's the sin. can make all the difference to your attitude if you make a list that's reasonable, and at the end of the day, or near the end of the day, or mid-afternoon, or even midday, you say, you know what? I've done everything I needed to do. Now I can take it easy. A little bit. But what I'm wanting to say is more than that. The seriousness of the consequences when things go wrong, I suggest there in the outline that in fact pastors are pathogenic agents. By that I mean they are the generators of pathology. Some fascinating research has been done in recent years examining the personality of the corpus body, the whole group, as in a church or sometimes in a Christian organization, examining the personality of a group of people and seeing how that personality relates to the significant leader of that group. For example, there's been some research on organizations that are founded by certain individuals. Who look at the personality of the organization and compares that to the personality of the significant founder. And what they always find is that there's a great degree of correspondence. one of our my and Kat's dearest friends is Shirley and Jim Dobson, who some of you probably have heard his radio program. We know them well, and Jim has built a huge organization focused on the family. It's just an enormous organization. It just fascinates me whenever I visit there how much the whole organization reflects Jim's personality. Now, that's okay if the personality is good, but what if the personality isn't good? Pastors are pathogenic agents. Sick pastors make sick churches. And the mechanism is not hard to understand. You see, first of all, sick pastors will attract like-minded pastors. Like-minded. So you attract people who are attracted to your pathology. Your pathology is the very point of their attraction. I'm not sure I should tell the story, but I think I perhaps should, and that is that Cap and I were involved in a very, very healthy, I consider it to be a healthy Baptist church in South Africa. One of the healthiest, in my opinion, had a reputation for being healthy. When we first went there as a newly married couple, we found this place was so full of love and care. People were open, people were non-defensive. In a church meeting, you could stand up and you could say what you thought about something, and you didn't have all sorts of people ostracizing you or telling you that you were crazy and stuff. It was a healthy church. People reached out, and it was the salvation of the early years of our marriage, this church. But there came a time, I wasn't at that point on the board of deacons or anything. There came a time when the pastor who had built that church, a healthy church, moved on. And they invited a new pastor. I didn't know him, hadn't been part of the selection process, but we went along to church that Sunday morning when the pastor preached his first sermon. And he held forth. And on the way home from church that day, I driving the car, and I started crying. My tears just came. I couldn't contain my tears. My wife, there were three young girls in the back of the car. My wife said, "Honey, what's wrong? What's wrong?" I said, "I feel so sad. I feel so sorry for this church. I feel so sorry for this church." "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I don't know, but that pastor this morning, all I could see in his sermon was paranoia, suspicion. His preaching style was he would shout and he would give forth, and then he would take his Bible and he would throw it down on top of the pulpit. And he ended the sermon with some dramatic remark and then walked out of the pulpit into his vestry at the back. Stunned silence. Some of the people said, "Wow. Wasn't that great?" I went home and cried. Because all I saw was this paranoia. I said to my wife, "Honey, you know how beautiful this church is? You know how people just love each other? Many of the businessmen were in business partnerships together." And I said, "I give it a year and a half and this church will be a sick church." "Oh, you're exaggerating." Didn't take a year and a half. It took 9 months. You'd go to a meeting, and 2 days later, in the mail, you'd be a postcard from the pastor. "At the meeting, you said so and so. What did you really mean when you said that?" Question mark. Doubted your motive every moment. Raised suspicion. Very soon, people were being suspicious with one another. He fed one group's paranoia. "You don't really know what that other group's saying about you." And very soon, members who were in business together as partners start fighting. And then finally, this big lawsuit. Two members took each other to law. That's nearly 28, 29 years ago now. That church did not recover. It had 5 or 8 years or so of absolute hell. We had moved on. 25 years ago, we moved to the United States. And they lost touch with it. We didn't go back for a long time. And then finally, 3 years ago, Kath and I were invited back as part of an organization that I helped to found called African Enterprise. And we were having our 30th anniversary. And I went back. And the church invited me to come and preach, that same church, this large, beautiful church. And I got into the pulpit, and there were just a handful of people sprinkled throughout that church. Never recovered. Never recovered. Sick pastors create sick churches. But ministry is unique in the fourth point, and that is that it is unique in its ability to create healthy churches and healthy people. You see, this is the other side of the coin. If sick pastors create sick churches, then ipso facto, it must also be true that healthy pastors create healthy churches. Healthy pastors model health. They model openness. They model genuineness. They model transparency. They model spontaneity. They model, it's okay, you can be yourself. We'll still love you. Pastors have this unique opportunity, this unique ability to create healthy people. I marvel at the power of preaching. I marvel at the power of God. I marvel at the power of the Holy Spirit and all that stuff. But particularly, I marvel at the power the pastor has through just that short bit of time in the preaching process to bring people to closure on issues. But there's a preaching style that is destructive, and there's a preaching style that is health-producing. One of the greatest preachers I have ever heard is a preacher from South Africa in our Baptist denomination. And I remember he was in his 70s when I was in my early 20s, and he and I became the greatest of friends. He was the principal of a large African Bible college. Just a wonderful, wonderful man. I got to know him well through the years. And you know, whenever that man preached, I sat there. I just hungered for righteousness. He presented the goodness of the gospel in a way that I craved it. I didn't go away feeling like I'd failed so much. As I went away feeling that, okay, if I'm down, I can get up, start again. A tremendous capacity to appeal to the goodness in me and to connect me with the goodness of God. And that power is uniquely the pastor's. I work day in and day out, months and even years on end with patients to try to get them to forgive someone for some horrible thing that has been done to them. It takes years and years. And then one day I sit down and the patient comes in and says, you know what? My pastor preached yesterday on forgiveness. It's not a problem anymore. You've been coming here week in and week out for years. And you mean that pastor, one sermon, solved all your problems? Yeah. Yeah. That's the nature of preaching. Now go back for me, if you will. I'm sorry to take you backwards and forwards. But I want to pick up now for the closing part of our morning time. And let me remind myself when we finish. 12:15. For about half an hour now, and I want to try and finish a few minutes early, so some of you, surely you're itching to ask questions or make comments or something. So we'll try to give a few minutes for some question time. But there are five crises that are unique because of this interaction. I hope you can follow the flow of what I'm saying. We have this issue that who you are as a person is the key tool in ministry. What you bring in your person is what God is going to use or not use. And that's God's ordained way. And that's because only He gets the glory, nobody else. But on the other hand, we have this work that is so emotionally demanding. One study we did many years ago, a student that I cloned, who now in fact teaches our theology students for me, so I don't have to go through the pain of that. He does it for me. But in that study of ours, we studied four major denominations. We looked at all these hazards. And we looked at four different denominations because we wanted to see whether church theology or church policy or something like that had an effect on the emotional hazardousness of ministry. When we finished our analysis, we discovered that 96% of the hazards were common to all four denominations. It had nothing to do with whether you were conservative or liberal, whether your church polity was autonomous or congregational or whatever. 96%. It's the nature of the work. It's the nature of the beast. It's unique. And this interaction then has given rise to five crises. And my closing comments this morning, I want to structure around these five personal crises. First of all, I think there is a crisis today of authority. This running together, or this conflict between who one is as a person and the nature of the beast, has given rise to a crisis of authority. There was a time, you see, when the pastor had authority. When the pastor was the leader in the truest sense of the word. But things have changed. We have now this X generation. What's the latest in that? You know, the baby boomers who've started it all. We have a whole new ethos in church life, such that the authority of the pastor has now shifted away. And many clergy are confused about, I don't know what my authority is here. They call me to be their leader, and when I begin to lay out certain plans for them and some ideas and some strategies, they say, no, we don't want to do that. We'd rather do this. So I don't know what my authority is anymore. My power base is gone. And so many clergy, therefore, have begun to assert their authority in ways that is sort of inappropriate. There was a time when the minister was the most educated person in the community, when most people, when they wanted advice on almost anything, they'd go to the pastor for that advice. In the States, for instance, in my own field, the area of psychological illness and so forth, there was a time if you had a severe depression, a major anxiety attack or whatever, you went to the pastor. That has changed now. And so there's been an erosion of the authority base. And what clergy are looking for now is some sense of power, because that's what it ultimately boils down to. And in order to get that, what they are doing is that they're claiming this power in domains that they should not be claiming it in. Or to put it in a nutshell, you've got to choose your battles very, very carefully. Your role is as a spiritual leader. Confine your authority to that arena. Let me illustrate. So, a pastor and his wife about a year ago, they had gone out with their denomination as church planters. There's a growing suburb of Los Angeles that is growing tremendously, and they'd gone into that suburb to plant a church. And lo and behold, in a matter of 1 year, they had gathered 200 people were meeting in a school hall. And in a year after that, they were up to 250 members, this church planting situation. Things seemed to be going okay. And finally, this denomination required that a body like that had to meet for at least 2 years before it could constitute itself into a church in terms of the denomination. And the time came when they had their congregational meeting, where they were going to vote themselves into a formal church and establish themselves as a church. And they had the meeting, and they constituted themselves, and the first thing they do after they constituted themselves is they turned around and they fired the pastor. The pastor who had founded the church, who planted it. I've never heard of that. I mean, there's usually a strong allegiance. But you see, what had happened, you see, things have changed. These were mainly sort of yuppies. And their sense of authority was that, no, the pastor doesn't have all the authority. And furthermore, what had happened is the pastor had not picked his battles very carefully. One incident was had to do with a photocopy machine. He decided that they needed a photocopy machine for their office, and at that stage they had a sort of a functioning board. And instead of going to this board and getting permission to spend quite a large sum of money for that, he decided he was just going to go ahead and buy it himself. He's the leader. He's the pastor. He's the founding pastor. Until you are constituted as a church, you know, I'm in charge. I decide what is needed and all the rest of it. One of the significant leaders went to him one day and said, "You need to. You know that this is my business. I know about these things. You know that the model of copier that you want to buy is deficient in this and that and the other." No, he said, it's my job. And he went out and he bought this photocopy machine. And this group of men were absolutely furious with him. He didn't know his limitations. He didn't know what his strengths were or where he should focus his lines of authority. And that's what happened in today's world, isn't it? That you, every congregation has its specialists. You're not the authority on everything anymore. So what are you the authority on? And this particular board fired the pastor. You may be a great preacher. There's a lot of good qualities about you, but you're not a person that we can follow. Because we think that same style will be a problem afterwards. Everybody owns it now, you see. And this has given rise to a crisis of authority. The second crisis. Now one must respond to that crisis by clarifying for yourself what your purpose is and differentiating your contribution. What is it that you bring as the pastor, as the person who's leading that congregation? The pastors who are at greatest risk are those who sit on the fence. Because nobody knows what they stand for or where they are. And that's the concept of leadership, in leadership called leadership by differentiation. You lead by telling people, this is where I stand on that issue, on this issue, on the other issue. And you do it in a non-anxious way. Meaning simply that everyone else is given permission to disagree if they want to. But let me move on. A crisis of identity. This is a more serious crisis that has emerged recently in the church. A crisis of identity. Many pastors have no sense of who they are in ministry. Okay, ministry is strange in this idea that one can go through a whole life of ministry and come to a certain point and sit up one day and ask oneself, who am I? And the answer is, I don't know. Happens again and again. One of the reasons for that, this crisis of identity, is that one easily becomes defined by one's role. Your identity becomes defined by your role. You ask a pastor, who am I? And he says, I'm a pastor. There was a time we actually taught clergy, you know. Your identity must be 100%, 24 hours a day, it must be as pastor. But what is happening now is that more and more pastors are becoming confused about their identity. I have had the privilege of working in therapy with many prominent Christian leaders who come to a time in their life when they need to step down, when they need to retire, when they need to pass the job on to someone else. And they can't step down. There's one very, very dear friend of mine. I mean, I love the guy. I really do. But he reached retirement age not too long ago when he stepped down and could not surrender his title or his role. Because essentially, without that role, he had no identity. He wouldn't know what to do. His wife said to me one day, if he wasn't president of that organization, I don't know what he'd do. He would wake up every morning into a vacuum. He's got to have something to do, but it's more than that. He's got to have an identity, because his identity was his role. And so, what the board of this large organization had to do? They had to build him a separate office and get him a secretary. And they set up a little subunit for him within the larger organization so that he could go somewhere and continue to have a sense of identity. Now, I know from a clinical point of view that that man, without that, would have gone into a deep, deep depression. Because there's no loss greater than the loss that comes when one has no sense of identity. We changed president at Fuller Seminary a couple of years ago. It's about this July will be, I think, 2 years, 3 years, in fact. David Allen Hubbard was our previous president, remarkable man, appointed as president when he was only 32 years of age. And retired recently after a very distinguished career. One of the most outstanding Christian leaders in the United States, in my opinion. So we needed a new president, and we are provost is a man by the name of Richard Mao. And the time came when the board decided that they, after a international search, they would appoint our provost, who was the next person in line, president, provost, three deans, appoint the provost as president. And Rich, when he became president, said that he'd like to have a little retreat just with the three deans, just the four of us, on our own, by ourselves, to do this sort of this bonding thing, you know, this male bonding thing. He wanted to weld us together as a team. His very first day, it was July 1st. And the first day on the job, he wanted to be a retreat where all four of us would go off campus somewhere and we'd be together for a day. We could pray together. We could dream together. We could do some planning together. But mainly just weld ourselves into a new team. And the morning of that retreat, I will never forget, because Rich came in. The deans were there first. We were sitting down just in a little lounge in a Catholic retreat nearby. And Rich came in, he was the last one to come in, and he sat down and said, you know, I've had an interesting experience. This morning, July 1st, I went to my new office for the first time, the president's office. And I sat behind the desk, and there was some mail for me on the desk. And the very top envelope I picked up, and I looked at it, and it said these words, "To the resident Fuller Theological Seminary." And I was taken aback for a moment because someone's made a mistake here. To the resident Fuller Theological, they mean to the president. They left the P off. This is clearly a mistake. And he said, I actually felt offended by it. This is my first day on the job. And then he said, suddenly, a thought came to me that perhaps God had a message in this for me. So I put it down and I reflected for a moment that maybe, and even if it wasn't God directly, I said, I'm going to take this as a word from God. We can do that, you know. We can take it as if it comes from God. I said, I'm going to take this from God. It says to the resident. What is the resident? The resident is temporary. The resident resides. Doesn't preside, but reside. And I said, it's just forced me to accept this fact, and I want you all to know right here and now that I will only be a resident president. I will wear my role loosely. And there will be times that I will take my role, you know, it's like a robe you wear. I will take my role and I will take it off. And I'll set it aside. Certainly every day when I go home, I'll take off my robe, leave it behind. And the time will come when, even here, I will feel that my time is up. And I can promise you this, he said, I will wear my role loosely. And my heart just was filled with joy. This is maturity. This is maturity. There's a person who says, I'll know when I should reside and I'll know when I should preside. You've all been here. You're all the pastors here, you know, you're all presidents, aren't you? In a sense. You're presiding all the time. Must be awkward sitting there while I stand up here and do the speaking, the preaching. Don't you get fidgety? Don't you say, oh man, I could be up there. I could do a better job than that. You do it all the time. And you probably could. But you know, there comes a time. There comes a time, brothers and sisters, when you must. You've got to allow yourself to reside. Just reside. Just settle back there. Just relax. Reside. Take your role off. Set it aside. The more you can take that role off and set it aside, the more there will be an opportunity for you to begin to develop an identity in your own right. Your identity as a husband or a father. One of the roles I relish these days is my role as a grandfather. Boy, I take that so seriously. I remember what my grandfather meant to me. I said, wow, if he could mean that to me, then what could I mean for my 7 grandchildren? Wear your role loosely. Don't let your job define you. Don't let the role of pastor define you. There needs to be only a small part of you defined by your role. The rest of you must be able to step outside of it and stand there as a person and have a sense of identity. That means you've got to have a life outside of ministry a little bit. Otherwise you're one-eyed monsters. One-eyed monsters. The work of ministry is full of roles. The Auburn Institute once identified 76 distinctively different roles played by the average pastor. Some of those, not all those roles are compatible. For example, I won't have time to talk about roles because we don't have all that much time for this conference, but it's very clear to me that the role of counselor, the role of doing any in-depth counseling is clearly in conflict with the role of pastor. Pastors should not be doing any in-depth counseling. Because those roles are fundamentally in conflict. Now you sit and counsel with people, you know, I hear pastors say, well, I sit with them and I can get into some deep stuff with them. Then you get up in the pulpit and you preach one day and you're not thinking of them when you're giving some illustration about, you know, a certain person's life. That person thinks he's telling my story. And a whole bunch of other reasons. I honestly believe that these roles are fundamentally in conflict. But you've got to understand that those are only roles. They don't define who you are as a person. There's a wonderful scene in Leonard Bernstein's modern opera called Mass. So it's a beautiful scene where the priest starts to put on one vestment, one robe after another. My wife and I were very intrigued. About a year and a half ago, we were in Perth doing pastors' conferences there for the Anglican, and they'd opened it up for all denominations, but it was basically the Archbishop who had invited me to come. He had hated Fuller before. You know, Fuller gets hated by the liberals and the very conservatives. I mean, you're in a no-win situation. you can't be right for everybody. But he had softened, and he invited me to come and lead these pastors' conferences. And my wife and I lived in the flat little apartment they had in his palace, and looked like a palace. And every day he'd come in and we'd see him coming up the door, and he'd knock on the door and come in for a moment and say hi and greet us, how are you doing? We'd spent a few days there just taking a break. And we'd And we noticed that almost every day he had a different vestment on. And we remarked, these are pretty things. My wife loves these robes. You know, if she as chaplain could be given a special robe of some sort, you know, she'd gladly take it. She loves a uniform of some sort. She has threatened to go and join the Salvation Army because they have a uniform. She thinks it makes a statement, you know? It sort of says to the world, hey, look at me. You know, I'm in God's service. I spoke in Boston recently to a Salvation Army retreat. And she couldn't go with me. She wasn't able to go with me, but I called her when I got there and said, honey, I've got a big disappointment for you. She thought all these Salvation Army were going to come dressed in their uniforms. So I called her and said, honey, I've got a big disappointment for you. There's not one year with a uniform on. And they tell me that when they go on retreat, the last thing they want to do is wear a uniform. They just want to be themselves. I said, you know, that's healthy. Wow. That symbolizes, doesn't it? But in this Leonard Bernstein Mass, the priest puts on one vestment, one traditional vestment of the other. And as the archbishop took us into his little, I don't know, this vault, some of these vestments were hundreds of years old, and explained what each one wear. I mean, they were just beautiful. But this priest was putting on these vestments, trying to administer the Mass, until finally there's a sort of a sense of violence in the scene. He's staggering. He can hardly stand up. He's got all these vestments on him. And so he then begins to strip off these robes. One after another, he takes them off, until finally he's standing there just with a vest and a pair of blue jeans, barefoot. And he sings the song, look at me. There is nothing but me under all of this. Makes a powerful statement. Now, Baptist traditions, you don't have robes and things like that. At least I don't think so. Yes, you've changed it. But you know, we've got our other robes we put. We've got our roles, and we step into our roles. And some of us never ever step out. So we don't know who we are. Wear your role loosely. Wear your role loosely. Who you are is more important than what you do. Is more important than what you do. I'm always impressed with the story of Henry Nouwen, who was distinguished professor, Harvard University, can publish and sell books by the millions. If he'd kept that money, he'd be a multimillionaire many times over. Who decides one day that none of this was important. It all was getting in the way. You know, service, Christian service can sometimes get in the way of your relationship with God. And he said, this is getting in the way. I don't know God any better doing all of this than otherwise. So he decides to take a job for a year, lasted longer than that, at a little place called Daybreak. He, washing the dishes for brain-damaged children, washing the dishes day after day at that sink, just washing the dishes for children who don't even have the capacity to understand who it is that's washing the dishes. And he writes that that's where I met God. My service gets in the way sometimes, you see. I want to meet God so I can be a better preacher. I want to know God so that I can go and minister better. Oh, my child, I'm a pastor friend. There are times when God just wants to be with you. No ulterior motive. No special side benefit. No secondary benefit. Just you and me. Who you are is a living reminder of God. It's not a question of doing, it's a question of being. And you only get to that place if you can learn to surrender your role. Then there is a crisis of priority. A crisis of priority. Appreciated Steve's message this morning. reminding us of our priority with regard to the family. I had a pastor's son once say to me, I had a pastor but not a father. Had a pastor but not a father. Appreciate that. Crisis of priority. We have unbalanced priorities. And so families suffer. And children suffer. You can gain a church and lose a family. Those are the risks. Satan will see to that. The time is going. Let me also say that there's a crisis of integrity. Appreciate Keith and Stan and others reminding us of integrity, what that means in terms of honesty. But there's a crisis of integrity that goes even beyond that. And two areas that I would just like to mention briefly, because they are blind spots. Some of us often get, we have significant blind spots. The first area that I think where we really have to pay some very careful attention in the area of integrity is in the area of church planning, church growth. That church growth, one of its unfortunate consequences in some quarters, not all quarters, is that it has fostered a sort of competitive spirit. Where, the way I can grow my church is I've got to steal up some other people's churches, the members. The way I grow my church is to steal members from other people's churches. And so, we launch a visiting campaign into the neighborhood. We don't care what church they go to now. Come to our church because we've got a better deal for you. And the ethics of that has always bothered me. Those people come to my door. And I wonder about the integrity of that. Now, of course, people need to be evangelized. But one of the things that Rick Warren has impressed me with is that I think the statistic is something like 86% of the new members at Saddleback Community Church are previously unchurched people. And that it's Rick's policy to counsel everyone who comes to that church and gets a blessing and gets renewed, counsels them to go back to the churches they come from and go and make a difference there. Is that integrity or what? Recently, chatting to Rick, and he was telling me that one of their large Baptist colleges, I assume, had offered him an honorary doctorate degree. And when he got the letter, he checked his calendar and saw there that he had in fact promised to go and watch a soccer game that his son was playing. So he wrote back to the university and said, I'm sorry, I'm just not free that afternoon. Is that integrity or what? When a father says, I am not giving up my son's game to go and get an honorary doctorate from the biggest university in my denomination. Sorry, mate. See, I'm getting to talk like an Aussie now. By the way, there's an expression I came across the other day, something about, don't come the raw prawn with me. I have no clue what it means, but boy, I must learn how to use that. That's a great, don't come the raw prawn with me. I take it you all know what it means, because I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. But the other area of integrity that I want to hit on, and I appreciate Steve's comments here as well, but it's the area of sexuality. I mean, this tests our integrity more than anything else. If who you are as a person is reflected by what goes on in your mind, and I believe it does, then a lot of us are in serious trouble in the area of sexuality. I'm really concerned about sexuality. I wrote a book a year ago. I see that it is in Australia, called The Sexual Man. That book is based on a study of 600 Christian men, and I'll tell you right now, they're nearly all clergy, they're all pastors. I don't say that in the book, because when I did the study, I asked myself the question, every other study on sexuality that has been done, secular study, has tended to look at the fringes, asking the question, how bad does it get? Kinsey report, years ago, the Janus report, recently there's a study called the Sex in America report. They're all asking the question, how bad does it get? How many sexual partners are people having a week now, as they did 10 years ago? Like, I'm interested in knowing that. These studies don't touch my life at all. It doesn't tell me a thing about myself. I kept saying, when is someone going to do a study that will help people like me understand our sexuality better? So I said, well, let me do it. Launch the study. I asked the question, not how bad does it get, I asked the question, how good does it get? And then I asked the question, is it good enough? I wanted a sample, a large sample of good men, Christian men, married men, monogamous men. Pastors. Pretty much as good as it gets, I believe. And so I did the study, and I was appalled, quite frankly. Male sexuality is in serious trouble. We've lost our way. Male sexuality is, by and large, obsessive-compulsive. And I've been to Australia often enough to know it's no better here. If anything, I think it's a little worse, quite frankly, in terms of the culture. But be that as it may, the point is that male sexuality is in serious trouble. And so I wrote the book trying to draw attention to some of the key factors. We're not training our boys adequately. Do you know that 56% of married men, Christian married men, continue to masturbate to pornography after they are married? It was mainly women who bought the book. And I got a flood of letters from women saying, when do we get to tell our story? Well, my eldest daughter and I and another sex therapist, Christian sex therapist from Jack Hayford's church, we've launched a national study now on female sexuality, because I think that women are right. They need to tell their story as well. But we have a serious problem with sexuality. Sexuality, for the next centuries, this is going to be the greatest, the biggest challenge for us as Christian people. And the reason is because we do not talk about it. Our churches do not talk about it. We are not setting about building a healthy sexuality. Male sexuality has lost its way. It's got to be brought back on track again. The age of puberty continues to drop. There was a time when puberty was age 17, 18. You reached puberty and within a year you were married. And so there was a very short waiting period. Today what we see is that children, that the age of puberty continues to drop. It's now down 11 or 12. When I reached puberty it was 13, 14. It's now 11 or 12 and continuing to drop. My 12-year-old grandson reached puberty 6 months ago. We're having reports of 10-year-olds gang raping girls. 10-year-olds. Should be playing with Tonka toys or their skateboard or something. You know? And it's a serious problem because it's continuing to drop. Kids, children, babies now can have babies. I don't know what the solution is. The age of puberty is dropping mainly for health reasons. As the health gets better, some are suggesting that growth hormones in animals are coming through and that's lowering the age. Others are yet suggesting that precocious or premature exposure to sexually explicit material is lowering the age of puberty. We don't quite know the reason. But within another 30 years or so, 8 or 9 year olds will be reaching puberty. So imagine a 9 year old capable of making a baby, but not having the maturity of mind to support and keep a baby. And the best we can do is come up with programs to distribute condoms. Where's the message? Say no. I got into trouble 2 weeks ago at this other seminary because I was holding forth on this issue and I said, you know, I don't trust boys. I don't trust them as far as I could throw them. And I've got grandsons. If I was a father of a girl, I wouldn't trust a boy. So we better begin to empower our girls to say no, because until we can fix the males, the last resort, you know. Let's empower our girls to say no. Boy, they came down on me like a ton of bricks. Why should it be our responsibility, the younger woman in the audience said. Why should it be our responsibility? Yeah, I know. Why should it be? But what do we say? It's okay to say yes then? Well, I'm merely trying to communicate something of the frustration I feel about the area of sexuality. The whole homosexuality thing is out of control. I don't know, Australians seem to me to have capitulated to the gay agenda. We still got a little fight in us. But where is it all headed? Live and let live is the Australian way, isn't it? And I agree, yeah, live and let live. But where are we going in the area of sexuality? And we desperately need, and it comes back to us as in Christian leadership as to how are we going to deal with it. And lastly, because my time is gone, there is a crisis of dependency. It's a crisis of dependency. I have a friend who is a Christian psychiatrist, runs a retreat center for clergy at Marble Retreat in Aspen, Colorado. He's a wonderful guy. I just love him. Lewis McBurney is his name. And he has a retreat center where clergy and spouses, couples in crisis, can go when they're in serious trouble. He tells me this, that out of nearly 300 clergy couples that he has and his wife have brought into the retreat and counseled over the years, out of nearly 300 clergy couples, he says, he can barely think of one, possibly two, pastors who came willingly of their own accord to get help. This is what I mean by a crisis of dependency. We have difficulty residing. We want to preside. Physicians are notoriously bad as patients. Nurses will tell you. The worst patients are doctors. You know, there's a sense in which clergy can sometimes be their own worst enemies. That when they need help, they don't want to put themselves in a dependent position. They don't want to be seen to be less than perfect. And it's a crisis that has forced many that when they finally get to the place of needing help, it's already too late. A crisis of dependency. I've been encouraged to hear some of the things you are doing in this conference to build support groups for pastors. To encourage accountability in smaller settings. I think that's fabulous. I think that I have not heard it done as well and so organized as I've heard it described to me for what's going on in this conference. And I commend you for that. Because in the final analysis, this issue of dependency, you see, you can't open yourself up. You can't expose yourself to your own congregation. There can be no significant support from the people you minister to. It's got to come from peers. It's a level of peer support that one derives the biggest benefit. And a crisis of dependency is one that one has to work at overcoming. It's all right not to be strong. We've got to break the stereotypic negative image we have of anyone who is hurting and needing help.